Thank you, Stella. The opening there of Kafka's story Metamorphosis, translated, of course, from the German, one of the most famous passages in 20th century fiction and a product of Prague. Now, James, you've written a book, Excavating Kafka, in which you've shattered some of my deepest illusions. I assume that Kafka is this terribly gloomy guy who sums up this sort of Czech Central European gloom and torment. And yet, actually, this passage seems to be, in some ways, a much more kind of macabre, surreal type of humour. Now, is that the reason that perhaps we should think of Kafka as a Czech rather than a German writer?
Well, certainly, we have to locate him, I think, in a world which is almost impossible for us to reimagine. And this is this world of German-speaking and, in Kafka's case, Czech-speaking Central European Jewry before the Holocaust was even a twinkling in someone's ghastly eye. For obvious reasons, the Holocaust, it's almost impossible to reimagine that world, but Kafka was part of that. And unless we can stop reading him in the context of that darkest of mirrors, we're never going to understand the humour, which is absolutely central, as Stella brilliantly brought out there, I thought. Also with the trial. It's on record that when Kafka first read the trial to Max Brod and his other friends, they all, including Kafka, fell about with laughter, a reaction which would be rather rare today, but that's what we've got to try and get back to.
So maybe we need to rediscover the slapstick in Kafka. But could I just go with that idea which I think you alluded to there of division? I mean, maybe this is something that, again, is distinctive about the Czech writing and Czech culture rather than the other nations of Central and Eastern Europe, Catholic versus Protestant, Slav versus German. Is that something, that, again, that gives a very special Czech flavour to the writing?
There is. I mean, the notion that the Czech lands, whatever you want to call them, lie on this sort of fault line of European history is not simply waffle. For example, Bohemia, as it was then called, is the very place where in 1903 this thing called the German Workers' Party is founded, later to become the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Well before the First World War, it's the first place where racial divisions invade just the social democrat notion of workers altogether and so forth. It is one of the fulcrums of European history, again and again, you know.
Now, Rajendra, of course, you're a specialist in Czech language, Czech literature. To put it very bluntly, do you have to be writing in Czech to count as Czech?
I think that the burden on the Czech writer, certainly since the 19th century, has been in writing in Czech, is serving the nation by showing the language at its best. And it's led to a great focus on how writers write, how writers use the language, which is a very important part of
Czech. But what about this multicultural story that James has been alluding to here, which has, you know, this crossing, this transnational element with different languages all being part of a Czech culture?
It is interesting to look at the context of Bohemia at the time of Kafka, and I'm sure important too. But I think at the same time, Kafka clearly is looking back in German literary history, in a German literary context most of all. And I think his influence on Czech literature has been the same as his influence on other European literatures. It's not as a sort of... And I think, you know, the Prague Tourist Board takes a different view of this, but I think that, you know, they've tried to make him more of a sort of Czech son than perhaps he was at the time.
But absolutely. I mean, they're wonderful, and in from our point of view, tragic moments, really, from the early 20s, particularly when Kafka's first cousin, Bruno Kafka, who was one of the leaders of all the German speakers in then Bohemia, became a member of the new Czechoslovak parliament, and repeatedly made speeches in German in the parliament, which was perfectly allowed under Masaryk's constitution. And one of them, one of which, in tragic comedy, is a plea to the German officer members of the new Czech army to stop speaking German in public when they're drinking, because it gives the wrong impression.
I mean, there is something I just want to pursue a bit more here, Rajendra, because on the one hand, one understands, not just with Czech literature, but certainly with the Czech literature, that writing is part of the creation of a sense of national identity, and it's very important. But there is also a danger of a sort of exclusionism, which, of course, in European history has led in some rather disturbing directions, perhaps not necessarily in the Czech Republic, but elsewhere in the wider region. Isn't the linguistic barrier, putting a kind of hard boundary around it, potentially rather a dangerous way to define literature?
I think the thing that occurs to me is that the Czechs want two possibly contradictory things from their literature and indeed from their culture generally. I was thinking, I mean, since we're talking about music, that when Janáček writes about Smetana, who was the sort of father of modern Czech music, the first thing he says is that he's very Czech, that he couldn't be more Czech, that it's the interest in nature, the interest in the everyday. It's you know, this is what makes him Czech, his ability to evoke medieval history. But then the next thing he says is that he is an international composer who knows lots about Wagner and Liszt. And so, you know, you have these two things that have to be combined.
Do any traces of this turmoil, or this set of both hidden and explicit questions about the nature of Czech literature, reflect themselves in contemporary Czech writing?
Yes, I think they do in different ways. I mean, the very obvious example, which I'm sure is on people's minds, is Milan Kundera, who, of course, wrote in Czech for a long time, but emigrated to France in 1975, and his last three novels have been written in French, and the Czechs have an interesting view of him. The Unbearable Lightness of Being was not published for a long time in Czechoslovakia and the Czech Republic, and when it was, in about 2006, the reception was surprisingly positive, because the view of Kundera before that had been rather negative. He'd left, he'd gone away and stopped writing in Czech.
And I think we're also going to hear in a moment about a particular contemporary Czech writer, Daniela Hordrova, who reflects some of these conflicts in her own writing.
Yes, she does. I mean, she's another Prague writer. She's clearly influenced by Kafka. She writes about a Czech, a German Jewish Prague that is intermingling, that she experiences as a child. Yeah, and this is very much, you know, her interest, I think, is to break free of this very fixed national view of things.
Well, let's hear how she does that with an extract from Daniela Hodrova's novel Theta. Stella.
Eliška Barankova is standing in the slowly moving snake of those receiving the chocolate host from the fingers of Comrade Midas. Behind her stands Pavel Fink, and she can feel his hot breath on her neck. They are moving in small steps, baby steps, as they used to say in a game she played in the playground of her childhood. Suddenly, her head starts spinning. Is it from anticipation of that unbelievable sweetness, or from the breath of Pavel Fink, her first love? The closer Eliška comes to Comrade Midas, behind whose grey jacketed back brightly shines the red scarf of Mr. Horn, the more overpowering her dizziness. Eliška Barankova? She comes too in a trolley bus, on a red leather seat. Above her she can see kind eyes and reads anxiety in them. The corner of the scarf is tickling her face. Mr. Horn, who after all is a magician, takes an orange from his pocket, peels the tropical fruit and places the bloody segments in her mouth. Eliška Barankova feels that she is committing treason by receiving the blood of Mr. Horn and not the body of Comrade Midas. She is becoming from that moment the follower of another cult, one that is forbidden, pagan. And the next time Midas's chocolate chestnut is dissolving on her tongue, she will long for Hon's bloody apple.
Thank you, Stella. I mean, in that extract, Gendra, the word treason is used, and that's a pretty strong thing. We get this very strong feeling of a character in whom we feel this shifting and even betrayal of allegiances. Now, is that a theme that is very central to the way in which Czech literature defines itself, grapples with itself today?
Yeah, I mean, I think I find Hodorová very attractive as a writer because of this description of this situation. You spoke before about dividedness, but I think I would use the word intermediacy, which is quite a seductive way of looking at Czech literature.
What does that mean exactly?
To be in the middle, of things. And the communion metaphor in the passage that we've just heard is very important because it goes back to the Hussite demand that people should be given communion in both kinds. And Hodorová presents the Czechs as sort of permanently utraquist. They are on both sides at once, or they're in both kinds. And I think this passage, if a Czech of a particular generation were hearing it, would associate it particularly with the idea of a public and private persona under communism, that one sort of appeared in public to be sort of supportive of the regime, even as a child. Comrade Midas, you notice that then Mr. Chaun, who is the sort of private, the secret identity. But I think that Hodorová is going further than that. What I would just want to say is that she is looking at Czech culture as being a place where there is both this very fixed, imposed idea, which people, the collective, accept, whether it's national ideology or something else, and she's setting against this sort of idea of existence as something very fluid, very mysterious, very strange. She favours that, of course, but both things exist, so both things are there, so it's the intermediacy.
James, I wonder if you could pick up that idea of being in the middle, because again, both the Czech Republic and Prague specifically, I think you've said, have been a sort of prisoner of their own geography. I mean, the sense of place is very important in defining Czechness, isn't it?
It's tremendously. I mean, the question, and it's become one of the bugbears of the whole business. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about Kafka, to go back to him, is that one of the little known bits of his life is that there's a hospital which still exists just 2 miles within the present Czech border, which in Kafka's day was rather wonderfully known as Frankenstein, which he founded himself. He was absolutely instrumental in founding, but was only for German-speaking soldiers. So the comrade Schweik, the good soldier Schweik, rather, wouldn't have made the cut. He would simply not have been allowed in through this door. And that notion of where the boundaries are is not at all a theoretical problem for obvious reasons, even in modern Czech Republic.
But there's also something with this character who we've just heard about in the reading, Eliška, and also Gregor Samsa, who we started with. They both seem to have a sense of sort of victimology about them. Would that be fair? Sense of being put upon. I mean, this seems. I'm just wondering if that's something that maybe comes again from the tyranny of position, of geography.
Well, certainly, if Brecht's right to say that happy is the land that needs no heroes, I mean, the Czechs have been extremely unlucky in that they've consistently needed heroes, many of them tragic, failed, and executed throughout their history. And I think that's. I mean, how can one not feel that when one walks the streets of Prague, being aware as one is of the extreme. The ambivalence history involved in, for example, the buildings one looks at, which, of course, the majority were, if one's rather tactless about it, built by Germans.
I wonder if that idea of coexistence, also having two ideas, two halves that come together in one person, or perhaps even one nation, is a good moment for us to introduce the next passage, which features both a Czech victim and a Czech oppressor, and it's from The Cremator by Ladislav Fuchs. Stella.
"This is Mr. Ernst Wagner," said Mr. Kopfer-Kingel to the boy, who was trembling like a lamb and desperately squeezing his hand. "SS Sturmbannführer. He loved his nation and music. He will be buried to the sound of Wagner's Parsifal." Mr. Kopfer-Kingel smiled sadly at his terrified son. "Look. This Mr. Wagner is a thoroughbred German, not a soft, effeminate soul, but a man of pure blood. Every member of the SS, regardless of rank, must prove his lineage when he wants to get engaged or married. Laws are here to help people." Mr. Kopfer-Kingel smiled and then said, "He has a proper coffin, nice and deep, and wide. How would it be if you were to lie down next to him, Mili? Lie down next to him, and on Monday be melted down with him to the sound of Parsifal." And with a smile, with a less than jolly smile, he took the iron bar that was lying in the corner near the recess with a curtain, threw the boy on his knees and straddling him in his high black boots and tilted hat with the string and feather, he beat him to death with the bar. Then he lifted him from the ground and pushed him into the coffin with the SS man. It was a proper coffin, nice and deep and wide. They fitted in together like two stepbrothers. He hammered the coffin shut with pliers, checked that the bar and floor slabs were clean, adjusted his hat, and left.
Thank you, Stella. An extract there from a very disturbing novel, blackly comic perhaps, The Cremator by Ladislav Fuchs, which was first published in 1967. I mean, what is it that we should be extracting about the Czech nation from this?
Well, the novel is about a Czech man who loves his family, who also he works in a crematorium. He thinks that the crematorium is the ideal place because it functions to a timetable and everything, and it also is the way of getting rid of the bodies is putting them back into the universe, as it were. And he believes he's doing a kind thing. He's persuaded by a Sudeten German that he has German blood. He's reminded of his wife's Jewish origins, and he begins to see degeneration in his children, and he thinks he's doing a kind thing.
But Jinder, could I ask you a wide question and ask for a concise answer, which is not very fair? But tonight we're going to hear Dvořák, Janáček, Martinů, a whole variety of great Czech artists. We've been hearing about Kafka, we've been hearing about Fuchs from the Cold War, and Hodrova, a much more contemporary author. Is there some way in which we can find a commonality between these various cultural artifacts, these cultural products?
I would say that you have something which can be seen as quite conventional, quite even banal, quite straightforward, and then looked at in another way becomes something quite radical, experimental, subversive, and the two things are there, and we need to think about both of them.
That's a very Hussite, if I may say
yes,
so, doesn't
it? Is.
A great discussion, but I'm afraid now we have to check out from this event. So thank you all very much for joining us this evening, and thank you to my guests, Rajendra Chitnis, James Hawes, and Stella Gonne.
Tonight's Proms Literary Festival discussion was presented by Rana Mitter, and the producer was Zahid Wally. Well, welcome back this Sunday night, live here at the Royal Albert Hall, the BBC Proms. It's 24 minutes to 9 this Sunday. This is part 3 of our extended Prom. Petroc Trelawney with you here on BBC Radio 3. I forgot to mention earlier on, great scenes downstairs. Lars Vogt is in dressing room 2, which he's sharing rather wonderfully with Basil Brush. There's a great sign on the door. Lars Vogt's name at the top, Basil Brush underneath. Basil Brush will be joining with Louise Fryer to co-host tomorrow morning's Children's Prom, live on Radio 3 at 11 o'clock. Well, as the Prommers do their nightly charity chant, looking slightly bemused, I have to say, the players of the Czech Philharmonic are coming back onto the platform to take their positions. Dvořák's 8th Symphony ahead this evening, before it, a short work by Janáček, the Ballad of Blanik. Now, the Czech Philharmonic isn't a particularly international orchestra in terms of personnel. Most of its players are Czech. Earlier, I asked John Elliott Gardner how that affected the performance we're hearing tonight.
There's very few Eastern European orchestras that have held on to their particular characteristic sound, and the Czech Philharmonic really has. It's distinctive. I've been working with them for about 13, 14 years now, and it takes a while to acclimatise, but once you're in it, it's immensely endearing and immensely attractive, actually, for all Czech music, from the early 19th century music right the way through to Martinů, Janáček and beyond. And they stay faithful to that sound. One has to work at it, one has to bring it into the foreground, because otherwise they think they should sound international. But I love this local dialect, in a way, of sonorities.
Am I right in thinking you discussed this programme with Sir Charles Mackerras?
I did. I mean, Charles was a very good friend and a mentor to me all through my career. He and I have been sort of in communication and correspondence in a very collegial way. He was the most wonderfully collegial conductor. Most conductors aren't particularly collegial, but he was. And every time I've done a Janáček opera, I've done 3 so far, he would say, come round, I'll give you a driving lesson on Katya Kabanova or The Cunning Little Vixen or Yanufa. And he was always very generous with his learning and his whole research, putting it at the disposal of somebody younger than him. And I owe him a huge debt for that.
We're going to hear Janáček next, the Ballad of Blanik, a great patriotic outpouring of a man who was absolutely a paid-up nationalist.
Absolutely, he certainly was. It's funny, when I told the orchestra the story, they say, of course we know the story, but we never play the piece. So the great dramatic moment when the mountain splits open, the sacred mountain, and the sleeping knights with their swords are discovered to have been turned into plowshares. That doesn't come through very clearly in the music. What does come through is Gidi, the folk hero, his going for a walk on Good Friday, his going to the mountain, his approach to the mountain, his amazement at the mystic atmosphere within the mountain, and the great Wenceslas, who's there living in the mountain. And you feel, because Janáček is such a good narrative composer, you can tell the inflections of the story and the little kinks, and it's very graphic.
Well, the Blanik Mountains lie between Brno and Prague. There it was that St. Wenceslas's knights were sleeping but rose to defeat threatening invaders. John Elliott Gardiner taking his position on the platform to conduct the Czech Philharmonic in the Ballad of Blanik by Janáček.
Thank you.
Ballad of Blany by Janáček. John Elliott Gardiner conducting the Czech Philharmonic. Written in 1919, when dreams of Czech independence became reality after the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Well, the final work tonight takes us back to the man who conducted the first ever concert this orchestra gave, Dvořák. We're going to hear his Eighth Symphony, written amid the beauty of Bohemia's woods and fields. The Seventh Symphony had been filled with worries and probings. Now they seem a long way away. This is something much more straightforward and revealing. John Elliott Gardiner.
I think Dvořák 8 is in a way the sort of perfect symphony, because it's legible, it's intelligible to the listener. It's very familiar to many people, and yet it has all sorts of little mysteries and magic moments in it. And it's deceptive that it's in G major, because it doesn't even start in G major. And the slow movement has this wonderful evocation of the Eroica slow movement. And the scherzo is this glorious Viennese, or is it Pragian, waltz with a wonderful lilting trio section. And the last movement is superb theme and variations, which his imagination seems to know no bounds at all. He just goes on a trip and takes you with him.
Well, the first performance of the Eighth Symphony took place in Prague in February 1890, quickly followed up by a performance in London a matter of weeks later, both of them under the composer's own baton. John Elliott Gardiner returns to conduct the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra in Dvořák's Symphony No. 8. Thank you. John Elliott Gardner conducting the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra in Dvořák's Symphony No. 8. Sometimes called the English Symphony, as it was first published in this country. As well as that London premiere I mentioned, he also conducted a performance in Cambridge in 1890 when Dvořák was made a Doctor of Music here. A wonderful picture in the programme of Dvořák receiving his honorary doctorate. You can see it via bbc.co.uk/proms. Written just before he left for America. Described by Gavin Plumley in tonight's programme as being a veritable explosion of ideas. Dvořák said he wanted to write something different from his other symphonies. Woodwind players taking their bow. Now the brass, horns first of all. Thought the work might have been intended as a tribute to Tchaikovsky, who Dvořák had met when he visited Prague. Tchaikovsky had invited Dvořák to go on a concert tour of Russia, and the work was perhaps originally planned for that occasion. But in fact, it was premiered in Prague in the end. John Elliott Gardner shaking hands with Miroslav Vilimec, concertmaster of the Czech Philharmonic. A few new players have crept onto the platform. Don't know if there's any significance to that, but John Elliott Gardner's leaving the stage for now. Orchestra sitting down again. Dressed wonderfully formally in tails and white tie. John Elliott Gardner in what is his now characteristic Nehru jacket, complete with green silk trim around the bottom of the sleeves. Here he comes, back on again. This is the third of four Proms appearances. Be back here on the penultimate night of the season when he conducts performance of Monteverdi's Vespers that will fully exploit the spatial possibilities of the Royal Albert Hall. He's back on the rostrum now to take another bow. And the program's not quite over. And so 3 hours plus of music making from the Czech Philharmonic comes to a conclusion with Dvořák's Slavonic Dance, Opus 46, number one, John Elliott Gardner conducting. The orchestra will be heading back to Prague tomorrow, where their new season at the Rudolfinum opens on September the 8th with the performance of Janáček's Glagolitic Mass, conducted by Eliyahu Inbal. This is the Israeli musician's first season as chief conductor of the Czech Phil. Here at the Royal Albert Hall, it's a triple prom day tomorrow. Two proms here. Nicholas Cullen conducting his Aurora Orchestra in the children's prom at 11, co-hosted by Basil Brush and Louise Fryer. And then in the evening at 7, Keith Lockhart making his proms debut with the BBC Concert Orchestra. He's their new principal conductor, and he'll be leading a transatlantic programme, including works by Butterworth, Arnold, Gershwin and Bernstein. And the third prom of the day, well, that takes place at the Cadogan Hall, that recital, Janáček and Schubert by Lars Vogt. If you've just switched on, you missed his Grieg earlier on this evening. It'll be available to listen to for a week on the iPlayer via the Radio 3 website. John Elliott Gardner is back on the platform, clenching his fist, smiling at the audience, acknowledging his orchestra once again, and leader Miroslav Vilimec. With that, we bid you good night from the Royal Albert Hall. Back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House.
Petrok, thank you very much. That was Petrok Trelawney at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. And you can hear that prom again a week on Tuesday when it forms our proms repeat in the afternoon. That begins at 2:20. Or if you prefer, as Petrok mentioned, you can hear it via the Radio 3 website, bbc.co.uk/radio3, and then navigate your way to the Listen Again page. And if you'd like to submit your own review of tonight's prom, then you can do so on the BBC Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms, and there you'll find a button called Share. Well, what of the rest of the evening here on Radio 3? We take a journey into the afterlife tonight in our sequence of words and music. Dante, Milton, Wilfred Owen, Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman provide the words. Britten, Ives, George Crumb, Scriabin and Copeland provide the music. Words and Music begins at 10:30. And it's followed by an interview with Norma Winston in Jazz Lineup. She'll be talking about a new collaboration with many musicians that's produced an album that features music from as far afield as Mexico and Armenia, and as far into the past as the 13th century with the 13th century troubadour ballad. You can hear how all of those influences come together in Jazz Lineup at 9:45. Next, though, we continue our evening with a consideration of what began as a rather shocking manifesto in a Parisian newspaper and led to the launch of the Italian Futurists, who heavily influenced the wider thinking of 20th century modernism. Our Sunday feature tonight considers Luigi Russolo's The Art of Noises, in which he called, amongst other things, for a complete reappraisal of the classical orchestra so that it includes the sound of the modern world. The Art of Noises is in about 7 minutes' time at 9:45 here on BBC Radio 3.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Sir Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Two minutes to 10:00 it is. This is BBC Radio 3, and before our next programme, we'll go back a little further than the start of the proms to hear a little bit of Handel, the Allegro, from his organ concerto number 14 in A major. It's played here by the Concerto Amsterdam, conducted by Jaap Schroeder, with Daniel Schwarzsemper at the organ.
Thank you.
recorded in Haarlem in the Netherlands. Daniel Schortsemper was the organist with the Concerto Amsterdam, directed by Jaap Schroeder, in that Allegro from Handel's Organ Concerto No. 14 in A. Our composer of the week this week, incidentally, is Johannes Brahms. A week of programmes dedicated to his music begins with a programme called To the Great Joachim. It includes some of the pieces Brahms composed for his great friend, the violinist Joseph Joachim, in mind. And by the looks of it, the programme includes a rather special archive recording of the great man himself. Composer of the Week, normally to be found on Radio 3 at midday, is tomorrow a little earlier because of all of our visits to the proms. You can hear it at 10 o'clock. Well, next tonight on Radio 3, the Sunday feature, which explores the music and sound art of the Italian futurists. Emerging in Italy at the start of the 20th century, the futurists sought to capture the excitement of speed and the industrial age through painting, sculpture, architecture and music. 100 years on from their founding manifesto, Robert Warby explores the art of noises.
Excuse me. Mi scusi, signora. Cerchiamo il numero 23 di Via Stoppani. 23. Non sa.
23 doesn't seem to exist. This must be very disappointing for you. Well, looking for Russolo's studio, it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it is, but, you know, all the research that I've done on Russolo is pretty much epitomized by this kind of incidents. You look for things that are no longer there. You see, when you talk about Russolo, specifically the art of noise, you talk about instruments. Well, where are they? You talk about scores, and they are no longer there either.
This is the main square in front of the magnificent cathedral in Milan. I'm stood next to a large orange and black twisting sculpture that is drawing a crowd fascinated by its look and sound. In the centre, there are a number of large boxes with protruding horns. These are representations of intona rumori, noise intoners, originally made by Luigi Russolo. He was part of an artistic movement known as the Futurists, a brash, bombastic, iconoclastic group who published dozens of manifestos, one of which was entitled The Art of Noises.
Let's walk through a modern capital with our ear more attentive than our eye, and find pleasure distinguishing between the gurgling of water, air, and gas inside metallic pipes, the grumblings of motors that breathe and pulse, the throbbing of valves, the rising and falling of pistons, the screeching of mechanical saws, the jumping of trams on their rails, the cracking of whips. We shall amuse ourselves by ideally orchestrating together the rattle of a store's rolling shutters, banging doors, the hubbub and patter of the crowds, the different rackets of the textile mills, of the printers, of the electrical plants, and of the subways.
Years after its birth, there's been a renewed interest in futurism, with exhibitions, TV programmes and radio documentaries, reassessing the movement. While painting and sculpture has received much attention, its music and sound works have been virtually ignored. There are good reasons for this. The scores and the invented instruments of Luigi Russolo, futurist music's principal innovator, have all been lost, all except one 7-bar fragment. Yet his manifesto, The Art of Noises, has entered the folklore of the avant-garde. John Cage, Edgar Varese, and DJ Spooky are but a few who cite Russolo's importance. I've come to Italy to find out more and to ask, with so little of his work in existence, How have Luigi Russolo's ideas survived? And what did his art of noises sound like? This sounds like modern heavy metal music, doesn't it? This is like Extreme Noise Terror or Napalm Death or something like that, isn't it? It really is.
Il futurismo è un grande movimento antifilosofico e anticulturale di idee, intuiti, stinti, pugni, calci, zappi, specchiatori, purificatori, innovatori e velocizzatori creato.
Futurism was the brainchild of the millionaire poet Filippo Thomas Marinetti. Captivated by the excitement of the machine age, he launched the movement with a front-page article in the French newspaper Le Figaro on the 20th of February 1909. The article took the form of a manifesto.
We intend to sing the love of danger, the habit of energy and fearlessness. We affirm that the world's magnificence has been enriched by a new beauty, the beauty of speed. A racing car whose hood is adorned with great pipes like serpents of explosive breath is more beautiful than the victory of Samothrace. We will destroy the museums, libraries, academies of every kind. It is from Italy that we launch through the world this violently upsetting, incendiary manifesto of ours. With it, today, we establish futurism.
The founder of futurism, the man who pulled the movement together, the man who inspired Russolo and many others, was Filippo Marinetti. Here at the Foundation Stellini is a grand exhibition devoted to the life and work of Marinetti, and I'm joined by its curator, Luigi Sansoni. When Marinetti published his original manifesto in 1909, Luigi, what do you think was his grand vision?
Well, his grand vision was, you know, to change the Italian culture from the roots, from the beginning. Yeah, he really wanted Italy to be a very modern nation in all fields. Poetry, theater, painting, sculpture, photography, everything. He wanted a radical change in the Italian culture. The Italian culture was very, very tied to the 19th century still. And he wanted to change all this. He wanted Italy to become a modern nation, like England, like France, like Germany.
Vissuta voluta, creare vivendo, talvolta contraddirsi, affermare, lanciarsi, battersi, resistere, riattaccare, lanciarsi di nuovo, indietreggiare mai, marciare, non marcire.
He was a very good PR man. In a way, that's an art of noise. He's speaking out.
Well, Marinetti had a very loud voice, very deep, very profound. And when he did his declamation, people said that, you know, windows, you know, the glass of the windows or the walls, they trembled.
Questo programma minimo propugnava l'orgoglio italiano, la fiducia illimitata nell'avvenire dell'italiano, la distruzione dell'impero austro-ungarico, l'eroismo quotidiano, l'amore del pericolo.
So here we are downstairs in the foundation, and the wall is covered with futurist manifestos. This is astonishing. I've never actually seen an original.
All of them are original ones, yes. The original.
This is the manifesto for painting?
For painting, yes. Yes. And that's on the music, Manifesto della Musica. Okay. And that's the
famous one for war,
soli genere del mondo, yes. And that's the manifesto on the donna, the woman, the futurist woman.
Would you say that futurism was an art of manifestos? Why did they write so many manifestos?
Well, this was one of the big revolutions of Marinetti, because he wanted fusion to expand all over the world. And it was important to write manifesto because the manifesto soon after were published in different magazines. For example, when Marinetti wrote a manifesto in 1910 and 1911, after a few weeks, those manifestos were already translated even in Japanese. I mean, it was incredible. If you think at the time, you know, we are talking about hundreds, 100 years, a century ago, we had no radio, no television, no internet. It was amazing how, you know, this manifesto were all over, spread all over the world, you know.
So in what way was Marinetti's personality stamped on the futurist movement? He edited the other manifestos. He wrote some of them, didn't he? He co-wrote them.
He co-wrote many of the manifestos. The title of this exhibition is Marinetti Equal Futurism, because, you know, Marinetti was the futurist movement. I have a metaphor, you know, it's Marinetti stands to futurism like Christ stands to Christianesimo, the Christianity. Yeah. He really was the spirit, he was the heart of futurism.
That was a fabulous exhibition. It gave me a very clear insight into the personality of Marinetti. And it's astonishing to think that only a year after he published the first manifesto in 1909, he gathered around him all these other artists, all the other futurists, including the first futurist musician.
I loudly summon young musicians to the flag of futurism, which, launched by the poet Marinetti in Le Figaro in Paris, has in a short space of time conquered most of the intellectual centres of the world. We encourage the support and exaltation of everything in music that appears original and revolutionary, and consider as an honour the insults and ironies of moribunds and opportunists. The vegetating schools, conservatories and academies act as snares for youth and art alike. In these hotbeds of impotence, masters and professors perpetuate traditionalism and combat any effort to widen the musical field. The reign of the singer must end.
Mama.
While Luigi Russolo may have been the most radical futurist composer, he wasn't the first. The Manifesto of Futurist Musicians was written in 1910 by Francesco Balilla Pratella, an award-winning pupil of the famous Italian composer Mascagni. I'm with Roberto Androni, a composer who teaches a course in futurist music at the Cattolica University here in Milan. Roberto, was Pratella's music as radical as his manifesto suggests?
That's the perfect question, I believe, because that's the discrepancy you can immediately notice, that these words are much more revolutionary than his music actually was. And this is not only about Pratella, but probably also about the other followers of futurism in music, where you can hear a lot of traditional approach, both in form, harmony, melody, rhythm, exactly the opposite of what they were proclaiming.
But Pratella's musical education must have occurred at the end of the 19th century. Can you tell us a little bit about what was happening in Italian music at the end of the 19th century? What was radical for Pratella at the time?
Let's say it was just opera, 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 opera.
So this is why Pratella is so anti-opera.
Absolutely.
Because he was just steeped in it. There was so much of it around.
Everything was sort of a dictatorship of melody.
And bel canto singing.
Bel canto, melody. So he includes in this disgust also the Neapolitan songs. Practically all that made Italy famous.
He was just pushing against all that idea of the sweetness of Italian music.
Absolutely, yes. Everything that was... the tradition for him was cheesy. And sort of sentimental and therefore decadent and culturally ineffective.
Let's hear a piece of his, Lavatore Dro, written in 1915, I believe. It's the earliest surviving recording of futurist music. It's a recording made in 1920.
Mm-hmm.
did sound like a John Williams Harry Potter score, you know, the idea of the dreamy flyer, the sort of Italian Icarus. It's a scoring very, very Mascagni like, and yet, you know, beautiful, enjoyable, lively, at the most bitonal, you know, where you have the Petrushka effect of the modal superimposition of a G scale and an F scale in this sort of flickering harmony. That's the most revolutionary thing you may hear.
In Pratella's Manifesto of Futurist Music, he writes that enharmonic relationships are magnificent victories of futurism. What does he mean exactly by enharmonic relationships?
I think they should have used the word gliding, because that's what they meant.
Microtonal.
Microtonal didn't exist yet, but that was the concept much more. So it was not inharmonic in the spectral music sense of something away from the natural series of overtones, but enharmonic in the sense of constantly moving between pitches.
If he had the idea of microtonality, I wonder why he didn't realise it, because he could have realised it with those instruments, with string instruments. You can play microtonal music on string instruments.
Now, I tell you my opinion about this. My opinion is that Pratella was trained in an Italian conservatory, which he criticised, but that was the problem. The point of view was so narrow-minded that could not get away from the traditional approach to the instruments.
In February 1913, Pratella's music was featured at the Costanzi Theatre in Rome. In the audience was another futurist, the painter Luigi Russolo. He came from a musical family, but had no formal musical training himself. He emerged from the concert with an idea for his own manifesto, which he called The Art of Noises.
Dear Balilla Pratella, great futurist composer. In Rome, in the Costanzi Theatre, while I was listening to the orchestral performance of your overwhelming futurist music, a new art came into my mind, which only you can create, the art of noises. The logical consequence of your marvelous innovations. In antiquity, there was only silence. In the 19th century, with the invention of the machine, noise was born. Today, noise triumphs and reigns supreme over the sensibility of men. Some will argue that noise is only loud and unpleasant to the ear. To convince you to the surprising variety of noises, it's enough to think of the roar of thunder, the hissing of the wind, the thunder of a waterfall, the gurgle of a brook, the rustle of leaves, the horse trot that fades away, the shaky start of a carriage on the pavement, and the ample, solemn, and white respiration of a city at night.
I'm with Luciano Chessa, a composer and musicologist, and the author of a new book on Luigi Russolo's Art of Noises. In what sense was Milan a decisive factor, not only for Russolo, but for the development of futurism? Milan was a modern city here in Italy. What impact did that have on their thinking?
I don't think futurism could have happened anywhere else in Italy at the time. The city of Milan at the turn of the century was a place in which major construction were taking place. Russolo writes specifically about visiting the site where the station was being built, the sort of giant train station, central station here in Milan. He was there with Sant'Elia, the author of the Manifesto on Futurist Architecture, and he referred to those visits and hearing the sound of this giant construction being built.
He says that the invention of the machine had created not only many varieties, but also a competition of noises. Was he saying that traditional instruments could no longer be used in modern life.
Yeah, he said that they don't tell us anything anymore that is just as valid. We need to use, according to his opinion, the sounds that are more important for us, the sound that surrounds us, and the sound that in a way still stimulate us. He is very much concerned into that, the idea that that kind of sound may have been exciting and may have stimulated the ears in 18th century and 19th century, but there is a point at the beginning of the 20th century in which those sounds don't speak to us as clearly and loudly.
These instruments, the orchestral instruments, are now redundant. We need new instruments.
Absolutely, and he builds them. And that is part of the reason why he is so significant.
It's important to realise Russolo wasn't arguing for the inclusion of existing noises into musical compositions, anticipating the culture of sampling we have today. He wanted to expand the idea of music by creating an entirely new futurist orchestra. To achieve this, he proposed replacing traditional orchestral sections with brand new families of noises.
Family 1. Rumbles, roars, explosion, crashes, splashes, booms. Family 2. Whistles, hisses, snorts. Family 3. Whispers, murmurs, mumbles, grumbles, gurgles. Family 4. Shrill sounds, cracks, buzzing, jingles, shuffles. Family 5. Percussive noises using metal, wood, skin, stone.
Wasting no time, Russolo began building his new instruments, intonare mori, or noise intoners, to which he gave names like exploder, crackler, and howler. All of the originals have, alas, been lost or destroyed. Fortunately for us, instrument builder Pietro Varado has spent much of the last 40 years reconstructing the intonare mori, using photographs and the patents filed by Russolo. Along with musicologist and Russolo scholar Luciano Chessa, I visited Pietro's studio just outside Venice. This is the first time I've ever seen anything like this, and I'm confronted not by one, but by five.
Yeah, a flock.
A flock of intonare mori.
There you go.
They are absolutely incredible. They're boxes with horns on. How do they work?
Well, they have an inside mechanism. Most of them are built with wheels that are creating a friction over the strings.
So inside of these cabinets, there's a tight string attached to kind of a drum skin, which is at the where the horn is. The horn amplifies the drum skin.
Yes.
When you turn the handle, a wheel engages the string. And this big lever on the top, it looks like something from a railway for changing the signals or moving the points. But when you move it, it changes the pitch.
It does change the pitch, and gradually so.
Can I play this one?
Sì, sì.
What is this? It says Russolo
ululatore acuto,
meaning
high howler.
Here we go. I'm thinking all the time about the art of noises, but this is very, very musical. All of these instruments make very musical, conventional musical pitch sounds. But I guess that at the beginning of the 20th century, these sounds would not have sounded musical at all, because people were used to the sweetness of the violin
the cello, woodwind, brass, conventional instruments, and something that kind of, something that does that, mm-hmm. and I've got to raise my voice to get above the sound of it, must have sounded pretty vulgar.
Oh, I believe so.
What inspired him to make these machines? Where do you get an idea from to build a box with wheels inside it?
My answer to that has been that Russolo was aware of Leonardo da Vinci's musical machines. Leonardo designed a number of noisemakers between the end of 1300 to the beginning of 1400.
So Russolo had seen these diagrams of Leonardo from hundreds of years before, and this would have inspired him to maybe make these machines.
This is what I believe, and I was able to build this argument based on the fact that Russolo begins his career restoring Leonardo. As he arrives in Milan as a young man, his only apprenticeship in painting is being part of a team of the restoration of the Last Supper. And Russolo would have had access to most of this instrument very easily.
Leonardo would have been in his mind.
I believe so. And Leonardo actually was one of the few important figures of the past that futurists respected. One of the few. Marinetti mentioned Leonardo even as a futurist, a honorary futurist, in some of the latest diaries.
Can I try this big one?
Please.
This is huge. This looks like a coffin, doesn't it? It's a coffin for a small person. Could you just tell us what this one is called in English?
It's a low howler.
A low howler?
Yes.
Okay. Here we go. These look like very early loudspeaker cabinets. This might be an argument for the fact that the Intonari Mori are a kind of precursor of electronic music. This is said very often, isn't it?
Yeah, it is said very often, but I think more than because of they look like loudspeakers, they are factually precursor of electronic music because they offer to you a kind of musical synthesis. Synthesizers developed in time in the very same way that Russell developed his instrument. Before building the instrument, Russell designed the sound world in categories, and then he proceeded to build instrument that singularly take care of reproducing each single aspect. He is very systematic. So the similar taxonomy is observed by people working by early synthesizer. You have one box that does one kind of sound, and with that kind of quirky sound, through manipulation, you can have different pitches, or you can gliss between one pitch and the other. So conceptually, they do resemble the synthesizer.
In your book, you write there's a deeper meaning to Russolo's understanding of noise. Can you tell us a little about this?
Absolutely. His ambition was to recreate the world on a stage. And this is a point in which science and magic, in a way, are flirting together. There was, at the turn of the century, an excitement with newly discovered forces that animate the universe seems to be out of physical, tangible reach, and yet they exist. At the end of the 19th century, electromagnetic wave got discovered. X-rays get discovered. All the people, scientists especially, are interested in occult. They are running sciences, and the traditional science cannot explain this phenomenon, but eventually they will be explained. And Russell's machines are, in a sense, very close to these ideas. His goal is to capture reality, but then to force reality to do what he wants. This is the artist playing God. And if you played God, you are in very particular territories.
By the beginning of 1914, Russolo was ready to unleash his new instruments on the public and set about writing some scores for the occasion. All that's left of these scores is a single 7-bar fragment of a piece entitled Awakening of a City.
It has been the source of much speculation and several reconstructions, including this one by Daniel Lombardi, recorded in 1978.